I do think that this example of Imran Khan can show how social media and AI technologies can be effectively used in the face of state repression as well.
Already existing mechanisms to create and spread information have been so well oiled and worked so well. Like I said, like, you know, the BJP creates these content and they almost certainly get viral.
And I would say that what's distinct about the context that I study from maybe the West is that a lot of this misinformation certainly spreads or originates from social media, but also can take on a world of its own through word of mouth.
Welcome to Civics and Cynics, your politics podcast for the digital age. I'm Es Paz, Professor of Digital Technology, Governance and Policy. In this episode, your hosts, Dr. Umar Jan and Dr. Jamie Ranger, with our panel of expert guests, discuss, in the context of the Indian and Pakistani general elections, whether the panic about AI's influence in these elections actually came to pass, and how misinformation can drive vigilantism and political violence. Civics and Cynics is a project of the Path to Power 2024 research group that aims to develop a picture of the state of global democracy through comparative studies of elections in the 2024 cycle. Our research and outreach activities are hosted in the Hasse-Plattner Institute of the University of Potsdam and funded by the German Development Corporation. However, the ideas and opinions presented herein are entirely those of the speakers. Enjoy the podcast and remember, civics takes effort. So stick around till the end to hear what homework your guests suggest if what you hear in the episode resonates with you.
Hello and welcome to Civics and Cynics, the podcast of the Hasse-Plattner Institute's Digital Governance, Technology and Policy Research Group. I'm Dr. Umar Jan, your host, and with me is my co-host, Dr. Jamie Ranger.
Hello.
We are both postdoctoral researchers at the HPI's Digital Governance, Technology and Policy Research Group. Today, we are continuing our exploration of how digital technologies shape political behavior and also how new technologies affect democratic systems around the world. We are thrilled to have two incredible guests joining us today to discuss a very timely and relevant issue, how misinformation and disinformation intersects with political violence and electoral behavior in South Asia, particularly Pakistan and India. So our guests today are Dr. Niloufar Siddiqui and Dr. Kiran Garimala. Dr. Siddiqui is an associate professor of political science at the Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy at the University at Albany, State University of New York. She's also a non-resident fellow at the Stimson Center and a fellow at the Mehbubul Haq Center at Lahore University of Management Sciences. Our other guest today is Dr. Kiran Garimala. Dr. Garimala is an assistant professor in the School of Communication and Information at the Rutgers University and a leading researcher in misinformation, social computing, and computational social science.
Interesting. Thank you so much for those insightful introductions. So let's dive into the context of the general elections in both India and Pakistan. How do you think the political and social environments in India and Pakistan have responded to misinformation, disinformation?
So maybe I can speak a little bit about Pakistan and then Dr. Garimala can talk a little bit about the context in India. So I think there is a couple of different ways in which we can look at this. One would be disinformation, right? Which is elite sanctioned misinformation, where it's like very clear who is engaging in the speech, and in, you know, many instances, political parties have social media wings and troll armies and so on, where they are responsible for putting out information that is not true. And this is obviously not a issue that's specific to India and Pakistan or the global South. We see this in the West as well. And then there is the other issue of misinformation, right, where it's like not quite clear necessarily where the origin or the source of the misinformation is stemming from. And I would say that what's distinct about the context that I study from maybe the West is that a lot of this misinformation certainly spreads or originates from social media, but also can take on a world of its own through word of mouth, right? And so sometimes people get caught up in like, well, what is the social media usage? What percentage of people in Pakistan, for example, are really on social media? Mm-hmm. But I think what this question does not get to the heart of is that you can get your misinformation that somebody originally got from social media, like at the local vegetable vendor, right? And I've done focus groups with women who say that a lot of their information is something that they get when they go shopping every day, right? And the other thing is that traditional media sources like television often also get their information from social media, right? And so I think that there is a number of different ways in which this information spreads. I would say less than India. I don't think Pakistan is as, the Pakistani political parties, I should be clear, are not as advanced in terms of how they're using social media to propagate certain narratives. I would say that the current opposition party, the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, the PTI, is the one which has the most advanced social media bureau or wing of the political party. Before I pass it on to Garimala, Dr. Garimala, one other point on this is that when we are thinking, well, actually, let me pass on, and then I'll come back to this point. Go ahead, Professor.
Perfect. Yeah. So in the Indian context, yeah, I think as Professor Siddiqui mentioned, like the political parties have evolved like their game. Particularly, I mean, it's not political parties; it's just this one political party, the BJP, which has been in power for the last 10 years. They're back in power now. They have an unmatched game. So, they are the largest political party in the world, but they are really, really good at the social media game, particularly the WhatsApp game. And they've built this infrastructure for like over a decade now. And it's a really well-oiled machine that really, really works well. Like, you know, one of the findings from our research is surprisingly how much. So, okay, first is, there's this top-down nature of this spread of mis and disinformation. Mm-hmm. How much of it is mis and how much of it is disinformation? And it's really a very tricky question. It's really hard to answer, probably impossible to answer, because, you know, also you cannot really trace sources and things like that. If you think of like, okay, political parties being very organized, having these sorts of centralized, they're called IT cells. So like, you could call them like a social media wing that creates and disseminates content. Every political party has this. But in India, some of the parties have like really, really perfected this where they keep creating content, right? So you can have any political party have these social media wings, generate content, spread the content. Everybody does that. But what the BJP has figured out really well, surprisingly well, like, and I'm really not sure, like, you know, how, I'm surprised at how good this is not just that, okay, they create this content and spread it through their WhatsApp network. It actually is viral, meaning it actually spreads and, you know, people are organically forwarding these, bottom up. Like, you know, people like, you know, my mom, like, you know, they receive this content, they forward it to their friends, right? Like, so this is content that is not just a top-down push. Obviously, you know, if you can spam the market with whatever you want, but unless there's a sort of bottom-up take-up for this, there's, you know, it's really hard for these sorts of viral spread to happen beyond the BJP bubble or any other party bubble. And I think that's where this difference comes in terms of ability to spread mis and disinformation, is that, you know, this party has really perfected this game and is able to spread their narratives. Another aspect of this is also, you know, this sort of like normal elite media capture. Like, you know, in India, again, like the media, most of the mainstream media has been fully captured. Like, they're fully pro-BJP, like out in the open. Like, there's no hiding that now. Like, everyone says that openly. So, you know, that's another huge vehicle, like, you know, of broadcast, where, again, may not be outright mis and disinformation, but it's just, you know, definitely a lot of propaganda, a lot of hate speech that kind of spreads through this. So the other part of the question was about what is being done, right? Like, so, okay, you know, we know that these ecosystems exist. Firstly, okay, are they effective? Like, probably not as much as we think they are, right? You know, the election results show that. Like, again, you know, before the election, when we have the data, we see that, you know, there's no competition here, right? Like, one side is a behemoth, like, they really have this infrastructure. The other side is like peanuts in the game. Like, they really cannot do anything on social media particularly. Mm-hmm. But does it really translate into votes and things like that? Like, particularly the sort of misinformation game, propaganda game, probably not, like, you know, as much as we think it does. The other part is like, okay, what is being done about this? So, I mean, there is a thriving fact-checking ecosystem, like, you know, that's mostly led by like independent media in India. I think India has the most number of fact-checkers. Are they effective or not? Like, you know, that's another question. Like, but you know, there is definitely, you know, that understanding, especially in the journalism circles, on like, you know, that there is this big thing happening, and there's, you know, these actors that are really injecting a lot of narratives into the political sphere, and there are ways to, you know, try to counter some of those through, you know, your traditional, again, broadcast mechanisms, mm-hmm. like, you know, either YouTube or, you know, other journalistic outlets. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much. Perfect.
Dr. Siddiqui, you wanted to come back.
Yeah,
if that's okay, just jumping on these points, and I think they're really important. The only other thing I would add is, you know, we talk a lot about misinformation and disinformation, but one thing that I found in the Pakistani context is also that there's this very little belief in true information, which is kind of the flip side of belief in misinformation, right? So it's really hard to get people to agree on a set of facts. And so sometimes it's not that you believe, you're sure in what you believe, but you know what you don't believe, right? Which is whatever the established narrative is. Mm-hmm. And so what political parties, I think, sometimes effectively do is cast doubt on the official narrative. They're not necessarily presenting an alternative narrative that's convincing and compelling on their own, right? But what they're going to make you do is think twice about what it is that the present day party, the opposition party, the government, whatever. The other thing that I think the distinction that was just drawn between your propaganda, hate speech, and disinformation, et cetera, that's important, is that sometimes it's actually hard to distinguish between these. And that's because increasingly we see this in the case of India, that we have what is effectively hate speech, but draws on elements of disinformation. And what I mean here is, like, let's take, for example, claims about, you know, love jihad, for example, where it's like all Muslims are marrying Hindu women, or most Muslims are marrying Hindu women in order to convert them. Now, theories like this, which are really broad and aren't about specific incidents, are really hard to fact check. Because you're not talking about a particular incident that happened in a particular district in a particular state, right? You're saying generally Muslims are XYZ. Now, how do you fact check a broad claim like this? You can't, right? It's really hard. Same with like all these kind of broad conspiracy theories, which is like the Congress party is appeasing Muslims or what have you, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is where we enter in this world where it's really hard to think about these as fact checkable. But they're not really true at some fundamental level. And we saw this most recently in the United States when presidential candidate Donald Trump repeated the rumor on social media that migrants are eating pets, mm-hmm. right? And so it's, again, one of those things where we don't have a specific example of a Haitian migrant eating a pet. We're just telling you in general, migrants are eating pets. And so any attempt to fact check this, which was made by people, vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance was like, well, how can we really be sure, right? Mm-hmm. And so these kind of broad claims, I think, really are at this intersection of hate speech and disinformation, and I think are particularly dangerous, precisely because very little of what you can say will move someone who's prone to believing them.
Mm-hmm. So, for example, in the recent elections in India, there is a talk about how the misinformation and disinformation, it didn't work during the last election, especially because the BJP won, but not with the margin that it was expected widely to win by. So I wanted to ask Dr. Garimala about this. First of all, is this a valid assessment? Like the disinformation and misinformation during this election did not like actually stick, and why did it happen during this previous election in India?
Yeah. This is a really, really, really hard question. Like, I don't think we can really conclusively say on either side. Obviously, you know, anecdotal evidence. Okay, everyone went in with the pre-assumption that, you know, especially people like me, like where we are seeing all this data and we say, oh, wow, there's no countering voice here. And, you know, hundreds of millions of people are consuming this type of content. And like, they're really forwarding and really engaged in this type of narratives. So, you know, that probably translates to votes. And like, that really should have some sort of disproportionate outputs. And, you know, that did not happen, right? Like, so, but it doesn't necessarily mean like that, you know, this caused that, or like, you know, that caused this. Like, that's a very, very tricky question to answer. Like, I think, you know, why you know, that would be is also because, you know, obviously, India is still, like, you know, people are freshly coming onto the internet, like, you know, and there is, like, you know, already some sort of narratives around, okay, there is misinformation, there is fake news, you know, on social media, what you believe, what you don't believe. Again, like, there are already existing baselines on what people believe, and like, changing those beliefs just because you got a forwarded message may or may not be that easy. And on top of that, like, you know, there's the factor that, you know, most election campaigning and like people being reached out still happens through, you know, face to face, like offline channels, either, you know, face to face through rallies or through, you know, television and these sort of traditional media. So the and you know, when I talk to, you know, these other political parties who are really not betting on social media, that's what they bet on. Like, they said, okay, this is a very expensive and almost impossible to maintain like operation, like the social media operation, especially, again, like, it's not just that you create some content and push it, like, you really have to be in the field, like, where you have these operatives that forward these things, and, like, you know, it's a really complex game that really takes a lot of time to master, and it's very expensive to maintain. So instead of that, like, you put your resources in these other modes of campaigning that might have a better return on investment. Again, you go door to door during the election, probably that convinces more people than you spamming people with like 100 messages on WhatsApp on like why you should vote for a specific party. So, you know, all of these factors, I think, do play a role.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Siddiqui, I'd like to ask you about the holograms of Imran Khan, which is like the only thing I spotted when I was looking at the Pakistan election online. You mentioned before this idea of Pakistan being behind India when it comes to using these infrastructures to spread, well, messages, before we even get to the content of the message, but messaging generally. Novelty of Imran Khan being a hologram aside, where do you see the future of the spread of misinformation, disinformation in Pakistan? What kind of technological advancements might be embraced? I mean, and was the hologram even effective, particularly?
Yeah, those are great questions. You know, we talk a lot about the rise of social media in this kind of dangerous, nefarious way, which I think is fair. But I do think that this example of Imran Khan can show how social media and AI technologies can be effectively used in the face of state repression as well. And so we, you know, whatever we might individually think about Imran Khan, and most people who study Pakistan or are Pakistanis have strong opinions one way or the other about him. But keeping those opinions aside, Imran Khan and his political party, the PTI, were facing a concentrated campaign by the government prior to the elections in February 2024. This included a slew of legal cases against him and included pressure being placed on party candidates to not contest with the PTI. It included taking away the election symbol of the cricket bat from the party, which is really problematic in a country which has relatively low literacy rates. And of course, most importantly, Imran Khan himself was jailed, right? So when the campaigning was happening, the leader of the party was not there. He wasn't allowed to contest and so on. Now, in the face of this state repression, what the PTI did was actually quite clever, right? So what they did was they put together this speech that looked like Imran Khan was making, even though Imran Khan was in jail and he wasn't able to campaign. And so they used AI to their benefit by putting together this speech, like putting together snippets of everything. And I think they were, in my recollection, and I could be wrong on this, but my recollection was that they had noted somewhere, right, that this was kind of artificially generated and so on. And so I think this actually raises important questions about ethics, right? So was this ethically problematic, or is this ethically okay in the context in which Imran Khan and the PTI was contesting elections? The other thing that the PTI did was, it wasn't social media per se, but, you know, just using technological tools to their advancement. So when the election symbol was taken away from the party, nobody knew who the candidate was that was contesting for the political party. And so you had the PTI set up a website. You could, with the names of everybody who was contesting for them, you could SMS or send a text message to a number, and that information was provided to you. And the opposition, the other political parties, the current governing parties, did not use any of these tactics, right? And so what we found on February 8th, 2024, for those listeners who aren't familiar with the election results, is that the PTI, despite all of the efforts made by the government to make the playing field difficult for them, it did well, right? It did much better than expected. It received the largest number of National Assembly seats. And this is despite the fact that it's very likely that large-scale rigging took place. And, you know, that, and I just going back to the previous question that was posed about, you know, how effective are some of these, at the end of the day, like these narratives, this use of misinformation. And, you know, I'll just end on this point, which is that when we think about the PTI phenomenon in Pakistan, we're kind of going back to the very basics of like what determines voting behavior. And I think that sometimes we get a little bit too caught up in ideology and narrative, which I think is important, right? And that's the conversation we're having. But I also think that a lot of the conversation that's happening at the local level is about like pure economics, right? And so I think what really worked in the Imran Khan and PTI's benefit in February is that the incumbent government was ruling during a time of an awful economic crisis, right? And so the party that was held responsible for that economic crisis was not the PTI. Now, it's really hard for us to disentangle, right? Was this an anti-incumbent vote? Was it a pro-PTI vote? Was it an anti-military vote? Like, I think at some fundamental level, we can't really know. But it seems very clear to me that the anti-incumbent slash economy factor was at least one very important factor that our focus on ideology and narrative shouldn't take away from.
Continuing on Jamie's question about the artificial intelligence and elections, Dr. Garimala, in the previous elections in India, there was a huge concern about how AI was going to affect the elections at the start of the elections, but at the end it didn't turn out to be this. I don't know whether you will agree with this assessment or not, but it didn't turn out to be probably as bad as in terms of the AI and disinformation kind of intersecting. It didn't turn out to be that bad. Could you like speak on that? Like, what happened? Why was everyone so concerned about this? And second, why didn't those concerns thankfully materialize?
Yeah. So again, like a very, very relevant topic. Again, like in less than a month, like in a few weeks, we have a big election, and everyone is still concerned about this. Or all of this year, people are, you know, really concerned about what's AI going to do. And I think the fundamental thing here is like the democratization of production, right? Like, previously, if I wanted to generate like this sort of flashy looking piece of content, either an image or a video or a text, it really took some effort, especially when you're scaling it up. And like the concern, rightfully so, was that, you know, you have all these infrastructures, like the BJP has this huge machinery. And now if you supercharge that with AI, like, you know, already they have like these thousands of people who are doing work manually. But now if you have AI, that really multiplies and gets this sort of effect, like where their influence could really, really be much, much bigger than what it was, right? So that was rightfully the concern, like the production means are now really democratized, and especially, you know, it is a good thing that it, you know, provides a level playing field. Like, you know, you don't have to have an infrastructure like the BJP to kind of spam people, maybe, like, I don't know, to create a lot of narratives and to create these sort of personalized messages and all of that stuff. But obviously it benefits these incumbents who have existing infrastructures, because it really supercharges them, right? Like, I mean, obviously one person creating 1,000 messages is different than 1,000 people creating 1,000 messages each, right? Like, so that's really a different scale altogether. So that was the concern. Obviously, like, there are two reasons why it did not play out. One is that already existing mechanisms to create and spread information have been so well oiled and work so well. Like I said, like, you know, the BJP creates these content and they almost certainly get viral. Like, a lot of those narratives get viral. So there's really no incentive to bring in this new tool that then, you know, somehow like they have to master and learn and, you know how to use properly in a way that communicates well with their audiences, right? Like, that again gets this sort of viral nature. So there's that learning curve. It probably, you know, it didn't happen now because, okay, all of these, the AI, generative AI revolution is like 2021, 22, and it's not like a really enough runway for these parties to incorporate them effectively in their stack, right? Like that's the first thing. Like, so already existing, you know, narratives that are very, very easy to create. Like, so you just take an old video, reshare it out of context, or you take an old image, reshare it out of context, or, you know, things like that that are very, very easy to produce are already creating wonders for you, are already doing well in terms of their virality and reach and belief and things like that. So there was no reason to go over this, you know, and learn a new tool. That doesn't mean that that's not happening. Obviously, it might be happening, and, you know, it will probably, you know, some of these people will come up with creative ways to make use of these and do something, or maybe that's already happening and we don't know that yet, but at least it didn't happen during the election. The second thing with all of these, like, you're really able to boost up your production capabilities, you know, personalize everything. But the bottleneck with all of these, and that's what we are seeing also now in the US election, there was this OpenAI report recently, is, okay, everyone is using generative AI, you know, all the adversaries, all the, you know, names you want to name, like Russia, Iran, you know, China, everyone. But, like, the bottleneck is the distribution, right? Like, so obviously you can create millions of messages, you can create these hyper-personalized stuff, like, but if you have to spread them through your Facebook, your YouTube, your WhatsApp, whatever, like, and if the people who are in charge of these platforms, like, are, you know, the people who are in charge of the creation of the platforms, like OpenAI, for instance, have the tools to detect and reduce the spread, or, like, throttle the spread of those, that's enough, right? Like, so, and I think that's where we should be focusing on. Firstly, okay, some sort of, like, investing in the infrastructure that enables this sort of throttling, and but also not too much throttling. And the other is in terms of policy and, you know, things like that. So, yeah, so basically these are the two things. So, you know, people have been worried because of the production capabilities. It didn't happen because of, like, you know, okay, it's a new tool, and I think it takes time to get used to and make proper use of it. Obviously, it's also that the generative AI capabilities are okay, but not the best that replace current tooling, right? Like, so, you know, you cannot generate from this realistic video. People have tried, like, you know, but, you know, doesn't still look so great. Like, and it's also not a cheap thing to do that can scale up easily. And the other is, like, this these bottlenecks still exist, and they will exist forever, like, in the distribution. And that's where, like, I think a lot of the effect will come. Like, it doesn't matter if, you know, Russia or any of the bad actors really uses generative AI. If they're not able to distribute that properly, and the distribution channel is properly taken care of, that should be fine. Like, you know, these are the two things.
Mm-hmm. Moving on from the elections, let's shift towards your research specifically, Dr. Siddiqui. Your recent paper on vigilante violence in India and Pakistan explores the impact of unsubstantiated rumors on public support for violent actions. Can you please elaborate on that paper, on those findings?
Sure. So, you know, we've kind of been touching upon this in this conversation, but just so I'm explicit about what types of rumors are leading to vigilante violence in Pakistan. So in recent years, there has been an increase in violence surrounding blasphemy allegations. And so what I mean by this is that individuals, those can be members of the majority Sunni sect, but they tend to be mostly members of religious minorities. And so this includes religious Christians, Hindus, but also the minority Shia community, as well as a group of people called the Ahmadis, who many mainstream Muslims do not consider to be Muslim because of their faith structure. And so a lot of individuals on an individual basis are accused of blasphemy. And this can look like something from, you know, a rumor spreads that someone posted blasphemous content on Facebook, someone tore down a religious poster at the workplace, someone got into a fight with somebody and tore the Holy Quran, right? So it can run the gambit, but these are the three rumors that tend to occupy the space of blasphemy. And so in response to these blasphemy allegations then, or rumors, mobs come together and they inflict violence upon the individual who's accused of blasphemy. Now, I said that anybody can be accused of blasphemy, but I will note that often when it's a member of the majority Sunni sect who's accused of blasphemy, the violence is inflicted upon just him or her. But when a member of a minority is accused of blasphemy, then often the entire community bears the brunt of violence. So last year, for example, a Christian was accused of blasphemy and an entire Christian village was razed, right? So this is an important distinction between the minority and majority. Let me give you one more example of the type of blasphemy that occurred last year. So an individual, a lady, was wearing a dress, a shalwar kameez, which is the local attire in Pakistan. And on her dress, she had Arabic writing. She was, I think this was in Lahore, so she was going to a store, and a crowd of people gathered around her and said that she was wearing verses of the Quran printed on her outfit. Now, this was just Arabic script. If I remember correctly, it said the words life is beautiful in Arabic. It was not Quranic scripture. But facts didn't matter. And so the group of people gathered, and a policewoman actually saved the day because she pacified the crowd, and she took the woman who by this point the shopkeeper had put like a burqa around her and then took her away from the scene. Now, what's really fascinating about this is that the policewoman told the crowd, don't worry, we as the police will take care of this, right? So it wasn't so much that this woman didn't carry out blasphemy. It was that the writ of the state is what matters, right? And so it's like, let us handle this. Now, what's becoming increasingly problematic over the last couple of months, there have been two examples of violence that have taken place in police stations. So one was a police officer himself engaged in vigilante violence. So an accused individual who was accused of blasphemy was taken into the prison, saved from the mobs, only to be killed by the police officer himself. In other cases, people have broken into prisons or jails in order to carry out violence against this individual. So in our paper, we did a study of both this and simultaneously in India, we were looking at anti-Muslim vigilante violence, which often surrounds rumors about cow slaughter where it's illegal, or examples of love jihad, which I mentioned earlier, and so on. And so what we wanted to know was whether or not correcting these rumors, right, providing factual information that the police investigated and journalists investigated and they found that this had not occurred, whether this was sufficient to decrease both belief in the underlying rumor, but more importantly, in support for violence that occurred. And this is an important question because, as we were talking about earlier, sometimes it's not clear if the rumor is a pretext to act, right? In other words, that it serves like an excuse for people's pent-up anger against this minority group. But we found, and this was heartening, that across all the three examples of blasphemy that we gave in our survey in Pakistan, that providing the corrections did decrease both belief in misinformation and resultant support for vigilante violence, which I think is important. In India, we found that it was effective, but not on the most salient issue, which is that of cow vigilantism, which is important. Also, if you compare Pakistan and India, we actually found a significantly more movement, a positive movement in the Pakistan case than in the India case. The caveats of our findings, and this actually is motivating current research that I'm carrying out with the same co-authors, is that some cases corrections are not possible, right? And sometimes they're not possible in real time. So it's great that we can correct after we do like month-long investigations. But at that time, the rumor occurs and the mob gathers almost immediately afterwards, right? So what do we do in real time? This is an important policy intervention. And then getting back to the issue that I raised earlier, which is like some rumors are not really fact-checkable, right? So the blasphemy allegations in Pakistan have become increasingly absurd, right? So like in the case of the woman wearing the dress, even afterwards when people were like, oh no, this doesn't have Quranic scripture, half the people didn't believe it. So half the people still insisted, no, it was Quranic scripture. Even though the people who made the dress, which are based in Qatar, by the way, posted on their Instagram that we don't have anything to do with this. We're not putting Quranic scripture on our dresses. It's just Arabic. It's just a language that we speak, right? So what do you do in contexts like that where the fact checks are like not being received, right? Or not working? Or in the case of very broad claims about minority groups, like the Ahmadi's very existence is considered by some members in Pakistan to be blasphemous. So again, encouraging findings, but can't apply to all situations.
Interesting. Thank you. Dr. Garamello, we haven't forgotten about you. I will ask you some questions about your research. But I wanted to talk about you earlier. You talked about WhatsApp, and WhatsApp is a kind of different case because of the way that it's structured. And you've written about this. You've written about community engagement in combating misinformation on WhatsApp. And I wanted you to, could we possibly get an elaboration on what you found in that paper? What do you see as the main barrier to effective community-driven fact-checking, especially when it comes to politics and controversy surrounding hot topics?
Mm-hmm. So the context here is, again, like, you know, WhatsApp, because of the nature of its encryption, cannot have like a centralized top-down moderation, right? Like, so, you know, Facebook or WhatsApp cannot see the content that is spreading on their platforms, which is good to protect privacy, but bad in terms of like these sort of special cases where, you know, either there's you know, offline violence or rumors creating problems, you know, things like that. One of the solutions for this is to think of like more bottom-up solutions where, you know, okay, I'm in my family group and my mom is sharing misinformation, I correct that. That's much more you know, scalable, right? Like there's many, many people like me who can, you know, do this sort of local fact-checking, rather than like depending on some fact checker finding that content and writing about that and assuming that people will read about that. You know, that is not a scalable system, and it does not work because, you know, many people don't know about the concept of fact checking or the fact that they're receiving misinformation. Right? Like, so the solution for this, again, one of the solutions for this is to think of like, how do we engage members of the community to be vigilant and like correct misinformation that is happening, you know, when it spreads on WhatsApp. So what we did here is we have these huge data sets of WhatsApp groups and conversation in WhatsApp groups, and we have annotated a ton of information on, okay, this is misinformation, this is hateful, you know, this is propaganda, things like that. What we did is we looked at like responses to those messages, like do people actually respond and correct misinformation? Obviously, the caveat here is that, you know, this is a group setting, and maybe in a group setting, corrections may not be firstly the right thing to do. You know, if you know, I'm in a family group and I tell my uncle, hey, you're posting misinformation publicly, that's not a good strategy, probably. That's one big caveat, like that, you know, we're only observing the sort of group setting. And the findings are that, you know, this is not happening. Like, you know, that, you know, this sort of correction of misinformation, we see many, many, many instances of misinformation, the same misinformation that has already been debunked many, many times, being reshared again and again. And, you know, almost never, like, you know, maybe less than 1% of the cases, there is someone correcting misinformation, correcting the misinformation. And we looked at this in like cases where the groups are tight-knit, they're private groups where people know each other. We looked at them in public groups where people are strangers but are together because of some sort of cause, like, you know, you like a party, or a political party, or you like a cause, you know, things like that. So in any of these cases, like, there was no evidence of like this sort of public correction happening. So you know, I think you know, one of the things we reflect upon is how do we like actually make this happen, right? Like, it's not probably happening at the moment, especially publicly. But can we incentivize people in a way, and can we, you know, find the right type of people, provide them the right types of tools that can enable this to happen? Because this is one of the key ways through which we can, you know, reduce the spread of misinformation, correct beliefs, and things like that. Especially if it happens through these sorts of public personal contacts where you know people and they're part of the same community.
Interesting, thank you. And then part of our podcasts, you know, as we're academics, we like to assign homework because it's a pathology of ours. And we would be interested in whether it be an article, a principle to take away, could be a song, it could be just a piece of advice that both of you would assign the kind of virtual listener to take away from the podcast.
So I just read this book related to conspiracy theories and this question about like how to counter like broad ones. And it's a book by fact checkers and journalists in India called Love Jihad and Other Fictions, mm-hmm. Simple Facts to Counter Viral Falsehoods. And I thought it was a very compelling read about these various, mostly like jihads, population jihad, appeasement jihad, property jihad, love jihad. And I think all of those are really fascinating. And then if I can plug one more book that is not related to our topic of conversation at all, and let me just double check also the title of that, but I love, and I have my students read this book. It's called I Crossed the Bridge and It Trembled. Well, no, We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled, Voices from Syria.
Perfect.
Both great. Both great. Do we have any more homework?
Okay. So as a political scientist, like I think Professor Stiki like really gave, we've been taught through books and all of that stuff. Like my thing is, okay, I just read this OpenAI report on how generative AI is being used by, adversaries like Russia, Iran, China.
Thank you so much, Dr. Niloufer Siddiqui and Dr. Kiran Garimala, for joining us today and sharing your valuable insights. To our listeners, thank you for tuning into this episode of Civics and Cynics. We hope you found the discussion enlightening. You can always write to us through our social media channels or directly via email. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast for more discussions on democracy, technology, and civic engagement. Until then, take care and stay engaged.